Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
you hear me?
Oh, yes, I do. I hear you now.
Oh, I got you now. I don't know what happened, but I got you.
Okay, well, I think I'm going to start from ground zero and start all over again.
What I did was I
introduced you, and this is going to be a repeat for everybody because you weren't able to hear me. It's possible my sound was off. And this is Alan Phillips, our co-host, who has written Dispelling Vaccination Myths, an article which was published around the world and translated into Russian, Chinese, and several European languages in the late 1990s. It has been used in medical school classrooms in three different countries and appears on websites around the world and has appeared in publications ranging from an Australian grassroots newsletter to Indian homeopathic journals to the Hindustan Times and other European magazines. Alan's more recent publications include vaccine legal articles published in the Townsend Letter, the American Chiropractor, and the North Carolina Chiropractic Association's Health Trek magazine. And today is November 10th, 2010. You're listening to show number 4 of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the United States. So it's possible we have had 10 minutes of pure white sound on the air due to some technical difficulties, but it sounds like we are there today. I wanted to also remind everyone that we will probably be repeating ourselves quite often for those newcomers who are not familiar with basically the fundamentals of what we've been talking about. That is, the legal system is extremely complex, and each person has personal questions and situations that should be taken care of or might be taken on a case-by-case basis. There will be people who can surf the internet and get their answers met, but in a lot of cases, because we have 50 states having their own regulations regarding legal vaccination exemptions and waivers, we can't really on the show be making any blanket statements that fit across the board. Also, Alan has taught us in the previous sessions that there are people in many arenas, whether they're in a private home situation, home school, or in a public situation, sending their kids to public school, people who are in the military, veterans, soldiers, in the clinical setting, physicians, nurses, medical aides, and people who have adopted children, then also immigrants who are coming into the country. There, you can see the variety of needs and questions that people might be looking for answers to these, and we base these answers upon legal precedents that have been made in the courts, depending upon your geographic area. And that's just an intro to where we're going to go today. We wanted to answer some major questions that people have been asking us in terms of what are our rights. And we started to talk about the Bill of Rights in the last session together. I hope I've done a good intro for you, Alan.
Covered a lot of ground, Debbie.
Well, we missed out on 10 minutes. I don't know what happened there. We'll have to fix this, and people will be listening to white noise. I don't know whether they hung in for us. Okay. So people want to know what are their rights to, in terms of if do they need to be part of a church to get a religious exemption? What if they just want to? I mean, there's a bunch of questions. Is there just one that you want to start with?
Well, just go ahead and take one. In fact, that when you started there, do you have to belong to a church? Your point earlier was well taken that, for example, with regard to kids enrolling in school, that the specific law and what's required in terms of immunizations and what's allowable in terms of exemptions and the procedure varies from state to state and territory to territory. But all but a couple of states, Well, every state and territory has a medical exemption. All but a couple of states have religious exemptions, and then some 20 or so states have a philosophical exemption. And I'm sorry, run the question by past me one more time.
Do you have to belong to a church? Do you, you know?
Right. So,
and also part of that question is, as a American, United States citizen, your religious affiliation, I would assume, is your personal business and not anybody else's business. And what you do in that part of your life could be private and not have to be divulged. I don't know. How does that go with this whole thing of your rights?
So there are several different parts and pieces to that, but let me talk about the sort of, I think, a larger underlying issue there about what business is it anybody else's, what your religious beliefs are. And with this, we're talking in reference to religious objections, which can qualify for an exemption and waiver in most jurisdictions. It is all but a couple of states in terms of school exemptions and all the federal jurisdictions, such as military and immigration.
And military, you can get a religious?
You can get a religious exemption in the military. I mean, that's a separate conversation, you know, to explore. But the starting place I think we need to recognize is that while we often talk about rights in somewhat absolute terms, that there really aren't any absolute rights. That, and I joke a little bit about this as an extreme example to make a point, and I think I mentioned this once before, that you know we're not allowed to sacrifice goats and virgins in the name of religion. That's, you know, the more extreme example. But one less extreme example that has been a subject of litigation is, are you allowed to do hallucinogenic peyote or other herbals, remedies and mixtures or whatever, because in general those would be considered controlled substances and against the law, but can you do that if it's part of a religious ritual? So there have been some very serious and legitimate questions about where to draw the lines. But in the context of exemptions, the state of the law generally, and as it pertains to the boundary of our right to refuse immunizations for religious reasons, it ends where the state sees it has an obligation to impose on our religious beliefs for the sake of society, the benefit of society. So the place we see that most commonly in exemptions is, and most obviously, is when we make the distinction between routine immunizations and emergency vaccines. So that even though most states allow either a religious exemption or religious and philosophical exemptions, that in most states the laws are designed such that if the state declares an emergency, such as 11 states did last fall with the swine flu, so-called swine flu pandemic. I say so-called because there are many mainstream sources that have acknowledged that was not a true or real pandemic. However, the pandemic was declared, and so were many states of emergencies. If they decide to mandate a vaccine in the context of a declared emergency, exemptions go out the window. And so the state's point of view within the mainstream belief and understanding about infectious disease and immunizations is that when there's an emergency, it has the obligation, and most states have given themselves the right by enacting laws that allow them to mandate vaccines over your religious objections. There's sort of a larger fundamental legal principle that goes here that says, in general, there are situations where certain kinds of emergencies allow for at least temporary removal or suppression of rights that would otherwise be guaranteed. One of the classic examples that I use is that it's possible in many states, maybe most or all states at this point in time, but I can speak more authoritatively about North Carolina because I'm in North Carolina and familiar with some of the state laws here, that if you're a victim of domestic violence, you can go into court by yourself. You don't have to have the other party present, and ask the court to enter an order prohibiting the other party from having any contact with you and doing other sorts of things. That is, on the surface, a fundamental violation of due process. That is, for someone to have an order entered against them without them being there to offer their side of the story is pretty fundamentally unfair. But if there is a severe enough state of emergency, if somebody comes in and makes a very convincing case that they've been beat up and they need to get out of the house, or they need the other party out of the house because they need the house for the kids or whatever, the judge will enter an order. Now, when they enter an order like that, they enter a temporary order. They get everybody back in court within very few days so that they can hear both sides of the story. So it's not just throwing your rights out the window, end of story. It's a temporary setting aside of rights in order to address a compelling need. The question becomes, though, and that concept, you know, we can argue about any given instance as to whether or not there really was an emergency or whether the person was telling the truth or those sorts of things. But the general concept is I would assert, quite valid, and government needs the authority to be able to do that. In some situations, like if there's clear evidence that a child's being abused, you don't tell the parents, come to court next month so we can talk about this. You reach in, grab the child out of that situation, put them somewhere safe, and then as soon as you can, you have a court hearing where they can come in and tell their side of the story. Of course, in both of those examples, there are situations where the laws are abused to the detriment of an innocent party, and you know, individual cases vary. It's a complex situation to try to deal with. There's probably no perfect answer there. But the point is that conceptually there's a validity to the idea that we need to be able to, in times of legitimate emergency, set aside or circumvent some of the usual laws or procedures in order to deal with the emergency. The question, of course,
right,
becomes what constitutes a real or true emergency, who has authority to decide that, and who has authority to do whatever they might be able to do about that. In the realm of vaccines and exemptions, there's a pretty compelling argument that current laws in most states are set up in a way that allows the state way too much discretion and authority. It's too easy for that to be abused, even if exercised with a genuine intent to do the right thing. So, you know, and that is what gave rise to one of many different legislative initiatives, but the one that I'm focused on, the Pandemic Response Project, looking at the emergency health laws, where in a declared emergency we can have immunizations mandated without any exemptions. And I and the people associated with this project feel that's an overreach of authority on the part of states. We should be able to say no thank you to immunizations. Most states have laws that if you refuse the immunizations anyway, even if there's a declared emergency and there's no formal exemption, they probably will not physically force immunize you, but they will certainly potentially immediately quarantine you. And the way the laws are drafted, they can decide where that quarantine takes place. Translation, we could be thrown in government facilities against our will for refusing a vaccine that we believe is not helpful or maybe even harmful.
What kind of a facility are we talking about? And are we going to be put in jail with criminals and, you know, be in a very dangerous situation or very uncomfortable situation if such a thing might happen?
Well, I think some of the laws are not very clear on those points. I think it's unlikely that at a first stage or step that someone who is simply not immunized and they need to be quarantined in the view of the state would probably not be thrown in jail with criminals. But some states do have criminal laws for violating certain kinds of emergency health orders. And here in North Carolina, we have a law that you can get up to 2 years in jail if you violate an isolation order. That is, if you were diagnosed with an infectious disease and required to be isolated so as not to spread that, and you violated that order, then you could get up to 2 years in jail. So the laws, again, are going to vary state to state, specific penalties and so forth. From what I recall having read of the law here in North Carolina, it was not at all clear where you would or wouldn't be put. It's up to the discretion of probably local health authorities for each local situation, perhaps in combination with state and potentially other authorities as well.
You talk about being the preparedness for. You'll clarify more about the pandemic preparedness preparation that you're the thing that you're involved in. But what about the government themselves? They're not really prepared. Let's say they did declare a pandemic emergency. They don't. I don't think they have any place to put people, considering their jails are overcrowded and very poor condition. What types of facilities would we be put into, like the civic center? I don't know.
Well, it's a speculative point, but there have been FEMA camps, according to some information on the internet, at any rate, built around the country, designed to handle large numbers of people. But I think you raise a really good point. But probably the majority of people in an emergency, if they were directed by their government, would take the vaccines. And so the numbers of people who are going to outright refuse. I have a really interesting, comparison as perhaps one point of reference with regard to that. Since the pandemic, and especially in the last several weeks, I've gotten lots of calls from healthcare professionals around the country, mostly nurses, who are saying, reporting new policies being implemented around the country requiring hospital employees to be immunized with the flu and swine flu vaccines. And at this time, it's a combined vaccine that has both components.
Right.
And what I'm hearing over and over again is that the nurse I'm talking to is representative of a group or larger number of nurses, most of whom, for one reason or another, are against the vaccines but choosing to get them. Perhaps they don't want to make waves and be singled out, and mm-hmm. they're the next one who gets fired for no reason, but the real reason is because they were not cooperating. Or sometimes if you ask for an exemption and get an exemption, you have to wear a mask all the time. There's a whole separate conversation there about if and when that becomes discriminatory, because it can be. A lot of the hospitals appear to be using this mask thing as a coercive tactic to discourage nurses from asking for an exemption, and to punish those that do, and whom ultimately they decide to give the exemption.
Tell me a little bit more about what do you mean by this mask thing, that the people who do not get vaccinated, who are healthcare workers like nurses, have to wear a mask all the time? I mean, that's not really a big thing. They wear a mask often anyway.
Some do and some don't. But if you're told you have to wear a mask for 12 hours straight, day after day after day, that's just ridiculous. I mean, it lowers your oxygen intake for one reason, for one thing. But I had one professional call me who counsels employees, doesn't even have any contact at all with patients, and she's being told as a counselor she has to wear a mask, you know, all day, and that's just absurd. She can't counsel employees wearing a mask. The CDC only recommends, by way of the Federal Register, Department of Health and Human Services, back in as recent as June, was not, first of all, not endorsing mandatory flu vaccines for healthcare workers, and second of all, was talking about a mask policy where nurses should only be wearing masks when they themselves have symptoms and are interacting closely with patients, with rare exceptions.
Well, they shouldn't even be in the hospital if they're sick. Is that not right?
Well, it maybe depends on who you ask. That's not what they were saying in their formal position at that point. They were saying if the nurse – well, I take it back. I think part of what the Federal Register was saying did involve being home if you're sick. But if they had any sort of symptoms or lingering symptoms or whatever, they should have a mask. But there was nothing in there that I saw that said healthcare workers who aren't immunized should wear a mask all the time. And so I feel like that what hospitals are doing, and not every different hospitals have different policies about what they are allowing for healthcare workers to use or do or have to do to get an exemption. there's not consistent policy throughout the country. What the policies fall into, as I see it, three different categories of leniency or severity. To those categories, in my opinion, they're overstepping their legal boundaries. But they'll do that either because they think they can or because they don't care or don't know about the law that suggests otherwise. And if nobody challenges them on that or stands up to them on that, they'll do that. But my point earlier is that for every nurse that stands up, you know, it gives me a call and says, you know, I don't care what happens. I want to take the best shot at this I can because there's no way I'm getting that shot. For everyone who takes that stand, there are many more who are against the vaccine who don't take a stand because they're afraid of losing their job or something else. And I'm not placing any judgment one way or the other on any of these people. It's very much a personal decision as to whether or not you want to make waves and risk what maybe goes along with that or want to risk losing your job. You know, I can't make that decision for anybody else. I do commend those that stand their ground and speak out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that particular arena is a little more complicated than most of the other ones because most of the other ones, you're talking about a situation where there is a law that says you may have an exemption if you meet these criteria and here are the steps you go through. And there isn't such a law for healthcare professionals. Some states have laws requiring vaccines for healthcare professionals, but there aren't any healthcare professional exemption laws. So on one level, this is a legislative agenda item. We need to have state legislatures enacting laws allowing healthcare professionals to refuse vaccines for religious or philosophical or medical reasons. But what we do have is Title VII, a section of the 1964 Civil Rights Act that requires employers to reasonably accommodate their employees' religious beliefs. And while that doesn't say anything specifically about vaccines and healthcare professionals objecting to vaccines for religious reasons, what it says is that if they can reasonably accommodate them, they need to. Well, hospitals around the country have exemption policies. They vary from hospital to hospital, the specifics. But clearly, hospitals generally can accommodate because most of them are, to one degree or another, accommodating. The question really then becomes, well, what are the criteria? Who gets to decide? How far can they go? And so forth. And there's legal precedent that can apply in the situation to suggest that hospitals are overstepping their boundaries if they're requiring, as many are, for example, a letter from a religious leader or a pastor or someone, or requiring you to be a member of, say, something like Christian Scientists to have tenets opposed to immunizations. The First Amendment doesn't require that. Vaccine exemption, religious exemption cases have told us that it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion or which one you belong to, nor does it matter which one you belong to if you do. You need only two things. Your beliefs have to be religious, and they have to be sincerely held. Now, as to religious, I'll give you an example. There was one federal court case where a chiropractor said that his religious beliefs stemmed from his chiropractic philosophy. And in that particular case, the court said no, that the philosophy clearly is sincerely held, it's a strong conviction or what have you, but it doesn't really rise to the level of religion or religious belief. So that chiropractor lost that case. In contrast, there was another case, and there was the difference, it's splitting hairs between philosophy and religion. But just to show you the flip side of that, there was another case where
they might have been able to win, they couldn't win on a philosophical basis because he took the case as a religious case.
Yeah, it was in a state that only allowed a religious exemption, and he was arguing religious exemption. He was saying these are religious beliefs, and the bottom line is that for legal purposes, the court decided that his beliefs weren't religious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the courts are reluctant to get into things like deciding whether somebody's beliefs are religious or not, but there are some points where they really can't avoid dabbling in the question, and this was an example. But let me give you the flip side. There were parents who claimed that their religious or spiritual beliefs stemmed from their prior association with Native American Indians. In fact, three different tribes of Native American Indians, and they had the exemption upheld. So it doesn't have to be beliefs that are conventional, orthodox, what we typically think of or first think of with the word religion or religious in any conventional sense of the word. But they used phrases like, in fact, the Supreme Court, in looking at religion in other contexts, has used phrases like goes to ultimate concerns, which I interpret loosely as like, where do we come from, where do you go when you die, that sort of thing. Things that you can't really, at least at this point in time in our current society, quantify or measure, or, you know, it's things you have to ultimately, you take on faith or belief, or you don't. So I think that's, those are some very general concepts as a way of beginning to distinguish. But it doesn't matter what church you belong to. I've had clients that were Buddhist, Taoist, I've had a Hindu Sikh, I've had all manner and version and degree of denominational and non-denominational Christianity. I've had Catholics and Baptists, and you name it, I've probably had them. And all okay. of them, all of them potentially qualify. Now, there's sort of a caveat here, though. The federal legal precedent that answers these questions that I've been talking about, most of that comes from federal courts in New York. And there's a handful of federal cases from other states, and then there's a handful of religious precedent cases on vaccine religious exemptions from state courts. But most of what defines the boundaries are these cases from New York federal district courts, and one case from the Second Circuit, which is a federal appellate court that has New York and a couple other New England states in it. And legal precedent is only binding on the jurisdiction of the court that it comes from. So those cases that I just referred to collectively, the New York Federal District Court cases, those rulings are really only binding on New York. And so courts,
right,
federal and state courts in other parts of the country can come up with different rulings on those same questions. However, as a technical reality, as a practical reality, states around the country have been following the precedent out of those courts, probably because it's the only precedent on those points. So, so that's the case. But what we have is some states that still have a law on the books that says you have to be a member of an organized religion. Now, at least five different states have challenged that kind of state statute in either state or federal court, and each time it's been found to be unconstitutional. So there are court rulings that say it doesn't matter whether or not you're a member of an organized religion, but if you're in a state that has a law that says you have to be a member of an organized religion, then that is still, that law is still enforceable in that state unless and until it's challenged and overturned in court, or somebody, the legislature enacts a new law to replace that or whatever. But as long as that law is on the books, it's enforceable, even though there's federal precedent to the contrary.
Right.
So it gets a little bit more complicated, and it's real curious. There's one state, I think it was Iowa, that has one of those kinds of laws at the state statutory level. But the health department created a form that doesn't ask you what your religion is. So it looks, it appears that the state health department there recognizes the precedent out of New York and says, okay, for our form, we're not going to ask for what your religion is, even though the statute says you have to be a member of an organized religion. So states don't necessarily have to enforce the full extent of the law. It seems to me, now I'm guessing here, but it looks to me like the health department knows about the federal precedent. They're not going to go to any trouble to try to get the statute changed, because the statute, the way it reads, will discourage people who don't meet that requirement from complying. I mean, before even trying, because they say, oh, I can't do that. I don't belong to Christian Scientists or whatever, so I guess I can't get the exemption. And then they go on and get the vaccines. And the state health department would rather see people err on the side of getting the immunization. So they're not going to they're not going to challenge the law as being unconstitutional. But it seems at the same time that neither are they going to create their form in a way that invites somebody to challenge the law. So now I'm reading between the lines here with what I'm saying, that the objective reality is the statute requires membership in a church, their state health department form does not. So, you know, what really is going on beyond that is speculative on my part, but it's sort of interesting because it seems like
it is interesting. So you're saying that they're allowing the reader to think of it in one way when the law is another way. Really.
Well, potentially. I mean, it underscores, though, for a very practical reason, a point that I find myself repeating from time to time, that you can't just look at the statute and that's the end of the story. In most states, you have to look at the statutes, which is definitely the starting point, but you also have to look at the health department regulations. The health department regulations will often, if there's a form in your state, that's where it will come from. The health department will create it. Don't use any of those forms and affidavits and letters you see on the internet. They come from well-meaning anti-vaccine or pro-vaccine choice websites, but they come from people who aren't attorneys, and there are people who have used some of those sites' recommended forms and letters and the like, and have lost exemption rights because of it. The laws are different in every state. If there's a form in your state that works in your state health department will create that form, design that form, and make it available to you. So, but in any case, some states have the requirements and the procedure all bundled up in the statutes. You go to the statutes, you've really seen all you need to see. That's the case here in North Carolina. But other states, you really have to look at a mixture, a combination of statutes and the regulations to get the full right, the procedure. And this was something I discovered with a client a while back. And again, I believe it was Iowa, that here's somebody who didn't belong to a religion, an organized religion. The statute says you need to be a member of an organized religion. And we were trying to figure out how to deal with that. And I took what I now say in retrospect was a common sense step and looked at the regulations, discovered there was a form, and the form didn't ask. I said, oh, just go use this form. That's all you need to do. And so that's what the person did.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, we need people like you who know the ins and outs, the what the statutes are, what the different state, where to find the different state health forms and things like that. We have 1 minute left to the show, and that's how fast it went today. And we'll continue next week with the same line of discussion about what are our rights, what does the Bill of Rights say, and where are we as citizens in each of our different states and individual situation and area. How do we approach vaccine exemptions and waivers for many of the different areas that questions that we have? And you'll just give us the general way to look at the law. And I want to thank you again for being available, because I know tomorrow you couldn't make it for the show. That's why we did an early show.
Well, thanks for your flexibility, too. Really appreciate it.
Okay, so now I'm going to close up for today, and we'll see you the next week. Bye-bye.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Bruck on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Journeys can be again, so they do as we bring out the wisdom from within. Share your life, let your peace be observed. allow our souls to shine. Bringing forth a greater love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be unfurled. One by one we are changing the world. Lasting difference. We can't sit passively. It takes an act of loving will to cause a change to be. So light your inner candle and ever guard its flame. And as its radiance grows brighter to the world, it will proclaim. Share your light, let your truth unfurled. One by one we are freeing the world. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one we are freeing.